Good evening and welcome, brothers and sisters and dear friends and young people. Great to see you here this evening. So, tonight's Bible class is our first part of a double series that our brother Matt Oliver is going to present to us. It's going to be based on two wonderful characters of the Old Testament, namely Leah and Rachel. Great lessons that we're looking forward to there. And I'm sure that Brother Matt has prepared something that we can take home and ponder more on as we consider God's great plan that he unfolds in his word that we read tonight in the Bible. The subject that we're going to consider tonight is this study on Leah and Rachel. It's, as I mentioned, it's a two-parter, so he's kind of indicated to me that there's going to be a lot of introduction tonight. And we look forward to getting to know the subjects that we're considering here tonight more. And for that reason, we're going to take a reading of Genesis chapter 29, the first 30 verses.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for having me back. Love coming here, and I guess one of the main reasons is because this is a nice little intimate room. I just love it. I love looking out and seeing it's full. I'm sure it's nothing to do with me, which is, you know, but I also love the singing. I just love it. And it was wonderful to hear all that beautiful singing before. And thank you, Anna. I gave you a challenge. You've come through so far. We'll wait to hear the last one first before we give the full judgment there. But no, really good. Thank you very much. And Brother Ralph almost stole my thunder, but we'll recap a little bit. All right, a little bit. I remember that. Next time you're speaking at Cumberland, all right? Remember that. So, how different are things today compared with things 4,000 years ago? Unless you're a scholar in that period, you probably don't know. But I'll just bring out a few things that are a little bit different. So 4,000 years ago, it was customary to have a birthright which gave 100% right to the estate of the firstborn of the house. 100% went straight to that firstborn. That was customary. It was not unusual for a man to have more than one wife in those days. It was normal for a daughter to be 100% compliant with her father's will. It was also normal for daughters and their brothers to help around the house with all sorts of duties of the function of the house. Just remember that. That was 4,000 years ago, I know. Still something that's probably good for today. Arranged marriages are also normal. No, but they're not today. It's okay, Manny. So journeys also on foot, long journeys on foot, on the back of a dusty donkey sometimes. Even on a camel, if you had the money to own such a luxury beast, were very commonplace and life was hard. Yes, these were the things that were normal 4,000 years ago. But despite that, and as Ralph mentioned, there's something that is still exactly the same today as it was 4,000 years ago, and that is they were human like us. And therefore, the lessons which we hope to cover over the next two nights together are written and recorded for the very reason that we will get something out of it. And we ought to read them and learn as much as we can from these characters, because they essentially, when you boil it all down, are human like us. And God never changes. 4,000 years ago, it doesn't matter. He's from everlasting to everlasting. He never changes. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So we're going to look at some of the lessons that we've got over the next couple of nights. So what I want you to do, though, if you can really, really help me, and you'll get more out of it if you do this, is I want you to try and personalise as much as you can these events. Just put yourself in their shoes. And not just one of them, but as you go through, put yourself in their shoes and try and personalise what it must have been like to be in their situation. And just imagine for a second, and I've imagined this as I was going through this, just imagine if our lives were recorded just like this for all to see down through history. Just imagine that. And just imagine, and it's not just their lives that are recorded here, is it? It's their thoughts and their motives are also exposed. Just imagine that as we're going through it. All right, so As I mentioned to Ralph, we're going to do a little bit around introductions here, not introducing myself to you and all the rest of it. I know many of you. Introductions pretty much in this record. And then the second night, we're going to really hone in on some of those deeper lessons around these two sisters particularly. So we're going to start with Jacob and just do a little bit of an intro of where we're at. So we've got to go back a little bit. And we're going back to, we won't turn all these up because we're going to fly through this little bit pretty quickly. Oh, by the way, I've done some really funky stuff, as you'll note. All right, it's amazing. You wait. No, I don't want to distract you too much. So the background to this story, really, we picked it up from chapter 29, but if you go back a couple of chapters, we have this episode, of course, where Isaac is deceived. He's deceived by his son and his wife, if you remember the story, when they go to get the birthright. Because they know that Jacob is the one that's blessed above his older brother Esau. So they just couldn't work out how it was going to work out. So they decided to take matters into their own hands and they laid this trap for Isaac. And he was deceived. Well, of course, Esau learns about that deception, doesn't he? And you can see there, I've highlighted in red, this was his reaction. That once he's finished mourning about it and thinking about it, he's going to kill his brother Jacob. Now, I don't know if you've met Esau. I haven't met him either, but I reckon he'd be pretty scary. He came out looking like a man, apparently, even when he was a baby. He was a scary man that used to hunt things. So I reckon if your brother was like that and he said he's going to kill you, exit stage left pretty quick. And that's exactly the advice that Rebecca instructed Jacob. You need to flee. You need to get out of here because he's serious. He's going to kill you. And of course, Genesis 28, of course, Isaac finally understands. The penny drops. Ah, of course, the blessing was really meant to go to him. Jacob, come here. Your mum said to go to Haran. That's right. I want you to go there and go really quickly. But I want to add this. You're not going to marry someone from the Canaanites here, so go and find a wife while you're up there. And that's the message. That's the message of those few chapters. And so away goes Jacob. Imagine now, I was going to say, you ought to start thinking about this and imagining this. Imagine how he must have felt. Jacob is, he's a godly man, Jacob. But he's done something wrong, hasn't he? He's offended his father. He's offended his heavenly father, and he knows that. He's now fearful for his life, and he has to flee, and he's alone. We know he's alone because we're told later in Genesis that he left with only his staff in his hand. He was alone. No one travels alone in those days. And he made quite a distance, it would seem, in the first day. So he was running. He actually travelled all the way to, and it says there, to a certain place. And we find later that he calls that place Bethel, or the house of God. The certain place actually has the definite in the Hebrew is the place. And it's the place because he knew this place. And it's a place because his grandfather was given a wonderful promise there at Bethel. So you can see where his mind was. He was scared, he was frightened, he was running away. But what does he do? He wants to go and see if he has still got a God that likes him. He goes to that place. He's going to see God. And that shows you something about his character. You know, if you're acutely aware that you've offended your God, the first reaction is to hide, isn't it? Remember Adam in the garden? That's the first reaction, not to run to God. But this was the right thing for Jacob to do. He ran to God. And you know what? He was so exhausted when he got there. I know this because, I mean, seriously, who can sleep on a rock, right? No, but there was a lot of significance about that. We won't go into it, but he found a rock which was potentially one of the rocks of his grandfather's, when he erected the stone monument there. But anyway, he falls asleep on this rock. And God, of course, shows him that vision, this vision up here. Who can tell me what that vision's all about? Maybe some of the younger ones. Do you know what that's about? I drew it. It's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah, what is it? Perfect. And I'm glad you said what you did. You said up and down. That's very important. Do you know why? Because where do they start from? The ground. And who was on the ground? Jacob. You know what that means? That means that God was saying, I am with you all the time. And that's what he says. Jacob then vows a vow, and he knows, he believes it, he knows it, and he says, seeing God is with me, that was what he wanted, wasn't it? He wanted reassurance. He's offended his God, he's now reassured. He's on the run, but he's reassured that God is with him. Isn't that a wonderful thing? That's a message for us all. If we get ourselves into trouble, don't run away from God. You know, we limit God with our own thinking of what God can do in terms of his forgiveness of us. We limit him because of what we think he can do, but we can't do that. We need to go to him and say sorry, and because God's there waiting for us. But we have to make that step, just like Jacob did here. He made that step to go towards God. And, of course, Jacob blesses him. Sorry, God blesses Jacob and tells him that I am with you. And so you have this great promise that happens at Bethel. And the promise was this, that verse 15 of Genesis 28, we read, now behold, I am with you and I will keep you wherever you go. Well, that's good to know, isn't it? Because he's off on a journey. And I'll bring you to this land. Now, that's very important. I'll bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised to you. What a wonderful blessing that was. So in all parts of your life, God's saying, wherever you go, I'm with you. It reminds us of a couple of verses that we won't turn up as well, but in Psalms 138, we're reminded of these words, the Lord will do everything for me. O Lord, your mercy endures forever. Do not let go of what your hands have made. And we all know this other one in Philippians 1 verse 6 very well. I am convinced that God, who began this good work in you, will carry it through to completion on the day of Christ Jesus. And that's the sort of blessing that he's giving Jacob right here. So anyway, Jacob's reassured, isn't he? And so he gets up early the next day, and I've put up there the Young's literal translation of that phrase. He lifted up his feet. He had some bounce back in him. And away he goes on this great journey, and it's a long journey on foot, some 650 km. That's a fair distance going all the way up there. But he heads off on this journey. So then we note that Jacob, of course, is running away, and he was still in a very low point in his life, but he's got this enthusiasm, renewed enthusiasm. What does he choose to do about it? I'm recovering some stuff I've already covered. So he's now running off to this place. And before we get to the chapter we read tonight, I want to highlight some other concepts and bring that into our thinking, which will help us to understand these lessons over the next 2 nights. These are not from me, I've stolen them. I'm happy to admit that. I didn't really steal them because I actually contacted the person who said use them, which is Darren Taporis, you all know him well. And these concepts, I think, are really key, and it's something that has helped me to learn a lot in my life. They're kind of little joining the dot moments in my life. So I want to share them now. And it's a lot to do with how God works, the providence of God in our lives. How does God work in each of us? Because essentially when you look at this whole story, do you know what it's all about? It's really about God working in human lives and trying to get them to a situation where they understand and they believe him. That's really what it is. And he does it on a on an individual level, and that's really important for us to think about that, and he also does it on a huge level with the nations. So the concept of providence, you know, the word providence is not actually a biblical word, but the concept of providence is all throughout. And I'll share three thoughts with you here, three concepts. This one here, God does it in three ways. There's general providence, if you like. So all mankind, for example, fall under this category, with the rain on the just and the unjust and all that sort of thing. God provides for us, doesn't he, our daily needs. By his power, we live and move and have our very being. Yeah. Then there's a special providence. This is another category. This is where God's directly intervening. However, more often than not, we don't actually realise it until well after the event. But we know that the invisible hand of God has been there and done something to help us out. I'll give you an example of that. My grandfather, who was in the Second World War, he was enlisted, and he didn't want to fight, but he was in a company that were about to head over to fight the Japanese. Well, he, on the night before his platoon was about to head off, got glandular fever, really bad, ended up in hospital. That night, the plane never was seen again, got shot down. Over the next few months, he met a nurse who later taught him the truth, and he became his wife, her wife. Now you look at that and you think, well, was God in control of that situation? Certainly it would seem that it's a strange set of coincidences, don't you think? Yeah? So the challenge of it is to try and see in our own lives, how is God working in our life? That is the challenge of it, isn't it? And maybe we can't see it. Maybe we don't see it now, but maybe we do see it later. And sometimes the things that happen in our life don't always mean that, well, I'm going to have to see something in my life that proves to me that God's working in my life, because in actual fact, it could be that what God's doing in my life is actually affecting others' lives that we don't even know about. You see the point? So there's another, that's a special providence. And then, of course, you've got the miraculous providence. You know, that's the Red Sea stuff, you know. That's the stuff that, it's beyond, you know, contravenes the laws of nature. This is definitely a miracle. And there's lots of them in the Bible recorded. So that's concept number one. Concept number two I want to share with you is this one. Free will. Here's the two opposites, if you like. There's one called deism up the top there, where people have this idea of God that he's set up the world, but then he just lets it go and everything's by chance from that point on. It's all happening by chance. That's one extreme view. And the other extreme view is the Calvinism view, which says God, he set up the world and he controls everything. Nothing he doesn't control. Your thoughts, everything. But we believe in this other area, and somewhere in between is exactly where it is, isn't it? It's free will. God doesn't force us to do anything. He shows us what to do, definitely. So that's concept number two, but this is the clincher for me, and this is the one that I think brings it all together. Two dimensions. The body and the mind. What's God interested in? What's he really, really care about? I've got a couple of quotes here. The Romans one is all about Paul when he struggled with sin. Remember, he's trying to do the right thing, but he always does it wrong. And he's, you know, that those verses. But he thanks God that he's with him. And it's about the inward man. That's what God's interested in. Paul asked for God to take away the thorn in his flesh, didn't he? Did God take it away? No. It wasn't important to God. But what was important to God was the development internally. The inward man, though the outward man perish in Corinthians, it's our inward man is renewed day by day. And how do we renew that? By reading God's word. By talking to each other, by living lives and helping each other and allowing God to work providentially in our lives. just as he is going to, and as he has done in the lives of those characters that we're going to read about a bit more tonight. So I hope that helps you, but that sets a bit of, we'll sort of, as we go through, that'll come straight into our mind. So here we have Jacob. He's heading off now on this great journey, and I've just put this slide up for a while. It's a great slide, I think. It shows through Psalms that phrase, them that fear him. God's able to do amazing things, isn't he? And he will do amazing things for them that fear him. And that's a great safety net to believe that if we put our trust and fear in God, he's there for us. And Jacob's in that frame of mind right now. Okay, so we get to the well of Haran. Now, we've read this already, so from verse 1 in chapter 29, and so I'll just paraphrase it a little bit for you. He's encouraged by these events. He's come all this way, and he's got to Haran. And he gets there and he sees all these flocks of sheep. There's three flocks of sheep lying around. And it's, you know, the sun's right up here. It's in the middle of the day. And he says to them, he says, where are we? You're in Haran. Oh, Haran, okay. Do you know Laban? Of course we know Laban. Oh, okay. And by the way, there's his daughter coming right now. Can you see all of that line up there? He's thinking, wow, God's already, he's directed me right here. Not only that, he's actually allowed one of Laban's daughters to come to me. Amazing. So then he decides to say to these lazy shepherds, I call them. He says to them, come on, you lot, get up. And that was a little bit English, sorry. Come on, you lot, get up. Feed your sheep, water your sheep, and get out of here. They were lazy. Midday. And they go, oh, no, we have to wait for another couple of people to come, because once they get their herds, then we'll be able to get this big rock off the thing, and then we'll be able to water all the sheep. And once that happens, we've got to lift the big rock back on again. And so we've got to wait until the others come in. Jacob wasn't from that type of upbringing, was he? He wasn't a slow belly Syrian. He said, you guys should get out of here. And then as he's doing that, we come to verse 9. As he's telling these guys that, you know, come on, get on with it. Verse 9 we read, and while he yet spake with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. And it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, notice that, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban went near, and he rolled off the stone from the well of the mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice, and he wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother, actually means relative, and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. So there's the scene. So Jacob falls madly in love. Instantly in love. Anyone done that in the room here? Come on, Jimmy. Jacob falls madly in love. And it says there when he saw her, when he laid eyes on her, and that's important to note that. When he laid eyes on her and he got, whew, and it gave him an extra burst of energy, didn't it? He ripped that stone off. The other shepherds were waiting for 10 people to come and do it. He tears the thing off. Now, isn't it interesting? It doesn't say anything about what Rachel says. She doesn't say anything, does she? Well, it's not recorded that she says anything. But you know what? I reckon I can read her thoughts. Can't you? Well, there she comes. She's watching this man. And look at him. Isn't it true that we're human, right? Boys do that, don't they? They try and impress the girls a bit. She's watching this guy. That's a strange guy. And then he just ripped the stone off. Wow. Never seen anyone do that on their own. And then he proceeds to water. He's watering my sheep. Oh, it's not bad looking either. You can almost just read her thoughts. You don't have to say much, does she? Because then, oh, and then all of a sudden he kisses her. Yeah? And then he cries because he is so emotional at this point because God has directed him to his family. And one's a stunner. And she doesn't have to say anything because her action says volumes. What did she do? She ran to tell her father. That was it. That's all she had to do. He was in love. But I want you to notice in verse 10 the phrase there, his mother's brother. It's actually it's significant because it's written there three times in that one verse. What's it trying to tell us? Well, Jacob, of course, was his mother's son. As it tells us in Genesis 25 that Isaac loved Esau and Rebekah loved Jacob. He was closer to his mother, wasn't he? And she was a Syrian. And so now he finds himself in this familiar surrounds with his mother's people, the Syrians. But you know what? God brought him here for a purpose. He was refining him. Refining him. He was going to make him rich, of course, but he was also refining his character. And God sends Jacob to Syria, and get this, to get the Syria out of Jacob. Make sense? God's sending Jacob to Syria to get the Syria out of him, because there's a lot of Syria in him. He's a godly man, but he's got a lot of Syria in him. And you know what? He's got a lot of choices to make. And we have free will, like we've talked about. Jacob had free will. Romans 6, verse 16 says that we are free from sin. Did you know that? We're free from sin. Did you know that right now? We're free from sin if we decide not to obey it. We have free will too. Just as Christ did, just as these characters did. But there's a lot of challenges that go on in our lives, aren't there? So we come to the family in Syria. Now, it was great that they were able to share their profile pictures with me. So we've got the family there. Well, the ones that we are going to be looking at anyway. So verse 13, let's go to verse 13. So verse 12 finishes that she ran off to tell her father. Well, interesting character we're going to look at now. And it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son. What did he do? Well, he ran to meet him and he embraced him and he kissed him and he brought him to his house and he told Laban all these things. What is all these things? Well, of course, the whole story of him that we just recapped now, of course. Why was he so excited to see this man, I wonder? And Laban said to him, surely thou art bone of my flesh. And he abode with him the space of a month. Well, this is the time that I'm going to now introduce you. Before I do, though, there's a little family tree. It says Abraham's family tree. I think it's Terah's family tree if he's up the top. But it's highlighting Abraham, of course, through there. And you can see there where Laban fits in, Uncle Laban. Is the term we like to use. And of course, his two daughters there. So now we come to this man Laban, and I want to just spend a few moments introducing this character. As I said tonight, it's a lot about introductions. Here he is, there's his profile. He's an opportunist. Have you met any opportunists before in your life? Lots of them, eh? There's lots of them, and it's hard. Well, this man was also very difficult. He was a very strange mix of person. He obviously was well known and respected, perhaps, in the country. He wasn't all that wealthy, but to begin with, he certainly became wealthy. And at this point, all we're told that he's been blessed with two girls. Later, we find that he has two sons. But they're clearly younger. There's no mention of his wife or wives. He has brought up two lovely girls, though. yet they're very different from each other, as we'll find out. He commands respect from them and those of his household, there's no doubt about that. But he's a man who's driven by success, consumed by status and power. He has a veneer of being genuine, but he traps himself in all sorts of lies. He has so many hidden motives, and all of them are to always become the beneficiary of his cunning plans. That's the man Laban. That's the man that God chooses to send Jacob to get the Syrian out of him. He would stop at nothing to ensure his desires were accomplished. A human trait that was a strong trait within him. It's a terrible thing. And you know what? His sister Rebecca had that same human trait of not stopping until what she wanted was accomplished, and using cunning and deception to do it. And we'll talk a bit more about him in the next class. But Laban was above all of that, or should I say below all of that, was motivated by one single factor. Money. It was all about money. And the problem with that is that if you serve money, money becomes your master. And it became his master. And so we'll see a little bit more about this guy. In fact, why don't we come back to Genesis 24? This is where he's been introduced. This is the very first time we see Laban in Scripture being introduced. And we'll look at from verse 29 of chapter 24. It says, introduces Laban, and Rebecca, and this is going back some years, had a brother, and his name was Laban. And Laban ran out unto the man, unto the well, and it came to pass, now this is the most important part, isn't it? When he saw the earrings and bracelets upon his sister's hands, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister saying, "Thus spake the man unto me," that he came unto the man, and behold, he stood by the camels at the well. And he said, come in, you blessed of the Lord. What motivated him to say that? Come in, I'll look after you. Of course, because he saw the riches. He saw the bracelets. This is the very first time we're introduced to this man. And he lives a life, as we'll find out, exactly like that. Do you know, Apostle Paul tells us that we should keep away from Laban's. Do you know that? And those people like him. In 2 Timothy 3, it tells us that we should turn away from people like this, that are lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents. Remember that? Unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. They may have the form of godliness but deny its power. Paul says, turn away from them. You don't need to have anything to do with them. Laban, of course, seems very genuine at first as he runs and kisses Jacob and says, come and stay with me. But you know what? He's remembering, oh, someone from Abraham's family's come back. Wonder what he's brought with him. So, problem is, Jacob's got to stay with this man and he doesn't know that he's that way at the moment, does he? He thinks he's all very nice. And he's got a very nice looking daughter that he's in love with. So, he stays for a month. Let's go back to Genesis 29. Sorry. And he stays for a month, it says, in the end of verse 14. Do you reckon, I've got a question for you, do you reckon that during that month that Jacob was expected to actually work for his board and lodging? You reckon? Do you reckon there's a clue in the next verse? There is, isn't there? And this is immediately we start to see the real character of Laban, right? He says, oh, Laban says to Jacob, oh, because you're my brother, should you therefore serve me for naught? So you're serving me, but should you do it for nothing? No, I don't think so. That's how I read that. Because if you look in the next few verses, in fact, right through these chapters, you pick out how many times the word serve comes up. And that's what Laban was all about. He wanted him to serve him. Because this man was not a slow belly type of guy that sits out in the sun the middle of the day. This man works. And this man knows how to make things work. And he could see that within the first month of him staying around, not lazing around, but getting out there and showing his shepherds how to do the work. And so he sees an opportunity. Yeah, yeah, sure. Why don't we, you know, tell me what you want. What's your wages? Trying to lock him in, you see. So we go on then and we read that we're introduced then to the girls. Oh, did you like that one? That's great. I forgot that was coming. Here's the girls. Now, I know it's a bit busy. Hope that you can see that. I've sort of lined up both the same verses again. And anyway, it's just my strange little way of doing it. But this talks about the girls. What do we know about Leah at this point? We've talked a little bit about Rachel. But what do we know about Leah? Well, Leah, she's the older sister. Her name means weary and dull. Could you imagine having a name like that? Was she weary or dull? I don't know. She was definitely different to her sister Rachel, put it that way. Why? We're not told much about her to begin with, apart from her eyes. Something about her eyes. It says she had tender eyes. Depends what you think tender might mean, I suppose, but some versions have it that delicate or weak. What does it mean, though? Well, verse 17, this idea of tender eyes, does this mean that she had some kind of impediment, maybe? You know, like the eyes are looking that way and that way, or... I don't know. It doesn't really say that, does it? Is there some impediment? That made her weary, perhaps. She might have been something wrong with her eyes and she got tired very quickly. Or perhaps she just wearied her family. She was, you know, not good to be around. Or maybe, and that's my next line. How did you know that? That could be it too. So she's there, and you're right, she's there. All this stuff's written about Rachel, isn't it? She's beautiful. So there's something about her eyes. I don't think it's intended to mean that there's something physically wrong with her necessarily. But I really do think it's meant to show that there was something very different about her than her sister. I believe it's a play on words to highlight the different personalities, maybe, as much as any physical issue. It was noted that Rachel was beautiful. That she was also well liked. People liked her. People don't just like people because of their looks alone. So she would have had some kind of fun personality perhaps to match her looks. Whereas Leah, it said, or it isn't said, should I say, that she was beautiful. It doesn't say that, does it? But it doesn't say that she's ugly either, does it? It just says she has tender eyes. The word tender means... tender. Did you know that? But it also means weak or faint. And the word for eyed or eyes means outward appearance. But it can also mean presence, regard or resemblance. So we get nowhere, right? Essentially. So I think it's as much about drawing a clear distinction between the two women. Not only... perhaps by their outward appearance, but also by the way their personalities were and the way that they were perceived perhaps by others as a result. Rachel had a bubbly kind of exciting sort of personality. She was fun to be around. someone who was the first to put their hand up and a volunteer perhaps, or someone that was real sparkling in her eyes, loved to get out, get dirty and get out and be a shepherdess. Like she was that type of person. We've seen them before, haven't we? Those bubbly types. They're annoying. No, they're good. They're great to have around. They really are. And that was who she seemed to be. Whereas by contrast, Leah was less inclined to be the centre of attention, perhaps. More shy, maybe reserved, perhaps somewhat self-centred. Perhaps lacking self-confidence, a bit like we said before, maybe hiding behind the shadow of her most beautiful and confident sister. Leah, by contrast, didn't have the sparkle in her eye, but she was known as having dull eyes. Although Jacob may have seen her, you know what? He'd fallen in love, so he wouldn't have seen anyone after that. That's usually what happens. And besides, when someone falls head over heels, they just don't see anyone else. So this was Leah. She was not a shepherdess like her sister, but we will find out that she was a very godly person. And whilst there are many Rachels amongst us, there are, and it's great to have them around, there also are many Leahs. And we can't just let them sit in the corner. We've got to look after each other. You know, in verse 18, one thing we do know and we remind about often in this record is that Jacob's affection was towards Rachel. He loved Rachel. And this would have been plain to see by all. And so Jacob gives Laban his answer, doesn't he? That he'll give 7 years. It's like a dowry, I suppose, but it wasn't really. 7 years is a lot. But 7 years he was prepared to do that for. And Laban is agreeable to this and gives no indication whatsoever that Jacob that she can't be married ahead of her older sister. No indication whatsoever. Such is his reputation and his ability to deceive. So verse 20 then, perhaps one of the most beautiful ways to describe this love between Jacob and Rachel is in verse 20, where we read, "And Jacob served his 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but as a single day." That's what it says in the Rotherham. As a single day. Isn't that beautiful to put it like that? I couldn't write those sort of words to my wife in a card. I just wouldn't even think of that. But this scripture pulls this together. 7 years and it's like one day. So he loved her. Now, let's read on this next section. This is where it gets interesting. How are we going for time? Oh, I've got 4 minutes to finish this next section. That's dangerous. Righto. Well, what I will do, I won't get through all this, but that's fine. But let's just read through it and then we'll be able to recap a little bit next night. So verse 21, we'll read through to 26 and let's just see what happens here. So Jacob said unto Laban, "Give me my wife, I've been waiting for 7 years. Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her." And Laban gathered together all the men of that place and made a feast. And it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah and married Leah instead. But he couldn't tell, could he? Because I imagine they wear all sorts of things to disguise them when they're getting married. You would hope. Otherwise he's probably had a little bit too much to drink. Or maybe a bit of both, potentially. But anyway, he goes in and he marries Leah and he lays with Leah, as the custom is, and he wakes up the next morning. Right? Yeah? I might have said before, put yourself in their shoes. Can you imagine this? I just can't even imagine it. Not only can you not imagine it, I'm glad I'm not imagining it actually, James. Not only can I not imagine it, but he's gathered the whole village for this. He knew what was going to happen. He knew at some point there's going to be a scream, there's going to be some big thing happen, because he'd orchestrated this Laban. And I'll finish with a few of these points, and then we'll pick it up again next time, because what this does, it's interesting, isn't it? This is the irony of God's teaching. All right, the irony of God's teaching here is this. Rebecca used the younger to deceive the older, didn't she? Rebecca's a Syrian. Rebecca's brother Laban uses the older to deceive the younger. Isn't that amazing? You know, God teaches lessons all the time, and we don't always take on board the lesson, of course, but his lessons can be very, very ironic or very poetic in a way. And this is what happened. So what we'll do, and I'll skip forward because we'll come back to a few of the... Oh, you didn't get to see that one. This one's perfect too, look at that. We're going to pick up next week, and I'll recap a little bit where I didn't get to tonight because it's really important. But out of this action, everything changes. Everything changes. And you know what ends up happening? We get to actually delve deeper into who these two women are. We get to see who they really are under the surface. Because we're only just seeing the surface, aren't we, at the moment? But now we get to see what's under the surface. And we've got many questions. And sometimes these sort of studies, you come out at the other end with even more questions than we started with. But the lessons are really, really good. Really sure. So hopefully it's giving you a little bit of something. And hopefully we get through it all next time. Otherwise we might have to do a deal and... a dodgy Laban deal and get an extra knife. I don't know if that's better for you or me. I'm not sure. Thank you.